Les conférences du Collège de France.
Bonsoir tout le monde, bienvenue. Merci d'être là pour la quatrième et dernière séance de cette série avec Professor Vamos. So I'll switch to English. We're again very happy and honored that you've been able to come here and give this series. And today I think you will end on a global note, and I can definitely vouch for Harold's global approach to science and life in general. He's the chair of the World Health Organization Science Council that I'm a member of, and it's something that Harold deeply cares about, making sure that science is done around the world and also in the right way and with the right people and for the right people. So I'm sure that today will be, again, very inspiring. Thank you, Harold.
Okay, so Edith, thank you again for hosting me and introducing me. Let me just say a couple of things about my intent today. For those of you who've been to previous lectures in this series, this, I remind you, is the last one, you know that my goal has been to talk about how science is conducted. Science is, on one hand, a private matter, something that begins with the imagination of individuals, but it only works well in the context of interactions with other scientists who confirm or deny the validity of one's work, and more importantly, as an enterprise that is conducted with many other elements in our society, politicians, journalists, philanthropists, and many other folks who have an interest in promoting science, and then scientists need to work in conjunction with those who benefit from the work the scientists do. In my case, as a medical scientist, that means patients and patients' families and advocates for better control of disease. Today, I'm going to conclude the series with a fourth topic. I could go on for another several weeks, but this is what the invitation calls for, and that is four topics. And today we're going to talk about science as a global activity, and I'm going to approach this from two perspectives. One is making science available as a profession for people regardless of where they are. The world needs all the talent it can get in the scientific enterprise, and it is important, in my view, that we find ways for talent anywhere to participate. And the second aspect that I'll pursue is the question of how we make the fruits of science available to people around the world. I will allude at several points today about how science in general is done more intensively in the high-income countries, and unfortunately the benefits of science tend to be directed and received with much more frequently by those who live in those countries. And for those of us who believe that science should have universal outcomes as well as universal participation, any tools that we can use to promote the virtues of science to those in the poorer countries in the world is a good thing. And I will spend time talking about some of the elements that go into it: political support, funding, planning, advocacy, attraction of science as an enterprise to people who live in countries where science is not a common pursuit. But I need to begin with a little prelude here so you understand my own point of view. When I was a medical student in the 60s, I was interested in what we then called tropical medicine, the kind of medicine that Albert Schweitzer practiced, where people go out into very poor parts of the world that have seen very little science and try to bring the products of medical science to people living in poverty and without the benefits of scientific efforts carried out in their own countries. As a means of testing my commitment to that way of life, I went as a student for 3 months to a town in northern India, in Uttar Pradesh, town called Bareilly, where I worked at a mission hospital in called the Clarice Wayne Mission Hospital, still exists, and saw a lot of patients with TB and leprosy and other devastating and largely infectious illnesses. And at the same time, I saw a lot of India. I met Satyajit Ray, the famed cinematographer, and learned about what it was like to make movies about life in India. I encountered rebellious troops trying to suppress a Communist Party outbreak in the streets of Calcutta in 1966 upon my arrival. I learned a lot, but I also, in observing how medicine was practiced and the limits on an ability to do science in India, began to worry about whether this was a life that I could embrace. And those of you who might have been here for my first lecture learned that lecture, my enforced time at the NIH in the late 60s convinced me that I was better suited for laboratory life, and that laboratory life was likely to be more usefully conducted in a wealthy country like the U.S. And indeed, at that point, I turned away from clinical matters, decided to pursue a career in cancer research in this country. But this experience in India did leave me with a deep commitment to the idea that if I had the chance of promoting things, that I might be able to do that in a useful way. One of the things that I will talk about here is the way in which I've either participated in or studied very closely successful efforts to try to improve the doing of science and to increase the chances that the benefits of science are shared in poor countries. I've also been engaged internationally because all of us who run laboratories, even in wealthy countries, are highly dependent on people who come from all over to get trained. And one of my axioms for a career in science has been that science is basically international, and we don't want a lot of current political movements to interfere with that. And I show one picture of my lab group from the middle of the 20-aughts. This group, as you can see from the label, the labels come from all over the world, including countries like India and China and Taiwan and many other places where science is a little bit more difficult to carry out, although certainly over the last decade or two, India, China, and other places that once in my childhood didn't do much science are now contributing greatly to international science. But I want to make two general cases for how we go about globalizing science. And I'm going to do that by talking first about how we can create opportunities for either individuals or for larger sets of people, societies, nations, to participate in the enterprise. And I'll give you several examples of how I've seen that work reasonably well. And then I want to talk a little bit about some examples of how the benefits of scientific advances, learning how to treat infection with HIV, learning how to expand cancer prevention and treat and therapies to poor countries will be the part of the latter part of this lecture. And I will talk in different contexts about the approaches that have been used try to facilitate these desirable conclusions. So in the first part of this, now that we're beyond the prequel of the preview, I want to talk about four ways in which I've watched or participated in efforts to promote science in low and middle income countries. And we'll talk about an extensive experience of malaria, an experience that I saw only peripherally to promote cancer research in Africa. I'll talk a little bit about some other things that are perhaps less interesting, but fundamental to the question of how we convince people that that these efforts to make science a global activity are feasible and important. So, the first story concerns malaria, and it's one that affected me very soon after I arrived at the NIH as the director in 1993. About a year or more after I got there, the leaders of a small component of the NIH, the Fogarty International Center, proposed that we have a meeting on campus to talk about medical science in Africa and how we can make that a more vibrant activity. Traditionally, of course, NIH and other large medical research institutions have paid attention to diseases that affect poor countries, such as malaria, tuberculosis, AIDS, and others, but paid much less attention than I believe we should in the question of whether people from those countries were actually participating in such research activities. And at this one-day meeting that we conducted, it seemed to me pretty obvious that of all the possible topics that had been presented at the meeting as ways to bring forces together to train African scientists and to make work on disease that was particularly common in Africa, that malaria stood out as a potentially tremendously important topic. First, because although, as you'll see in a moment, malaria was common in several areas in the world, the burden of malaria was particularly large in Africa. The burden was increasing because of two factors. One is the prohibitions on the use of insecticides to knock off the carrier of malaria, the Anopheles mosquito, and in part because there was an increasing number of pathogenic parasites that caused malaria that were resistant to the major therapies being used. And that is still, of course, a major problem. But there were also new scientific tools that had not yet been well applied to the problem of malaria, particularly the use of genomic technologies to study all three components of the malaria paradigm, that is, the parasite itself, the malaria protozoa that causes the disease, the fly that transmits the plasmodium, and human beings who are the victims of the disease. In addition, there were new ways to approach the making of a vaccine, which didn't exist then, still is not all as potent as a vaccine could be, and new techniques to study production of vaccines or production of drugs using characteristics of the proteins that are encoded by the genes of the malaria parasite. There were also opportunities for collaboration. Many organizations, including the Pasteur Institute, that I'll mention again in a moment, but many others as well, had already made some investments in malaria research and would be good partners to try to promote work on malaria by African scientists. And then, as I will describe in a little bit of detail, the NIH itself had some experience in trying to promote the training and conduct of research on malaria in a very poor country, Mali. I remind you that there had been many, many decades ago work by largely European and some American scientists studying malaria to establish some fundamental facts about the disease. One of your French colleagues, Charles Laveran, discovered the agent, the protozoa, that causes the disease while he was working in Algeria. He received the Nobel Prize for that in 1907. An Englishman, Ronald Ross, went to India where in the 19th century he discovered that the Anopheles mosquito was the vector that transmitted the disease. He too received a Nobel Prize even a little earlier in 1902. As I mentioned, malaria is found in several parts of the world, but Africa is not only carrying the greatest burden, but has the largest number of patients who have drug-resistant disease, and it made a lot of sense to try to focus a new effort on in Africa and to make use of the potential talent there by training more Africans to do research on malaria. To try to promote that idea, we teamed up with the Pasteur Institute and in particular its director, Maxime Schwartz, who I'm very pleased to say is in the audience today. Maxime and I and our colleagues put together a meeting that was held in Dakar, Senegal in 1997 that was unusually attended by equal numbers of scientists who were based in Africa, African scientists from in Europe and in the US. And 150 people discussed for a couple of days how we might improve the conduct of research on malaria. And came up at the end of our meeting with a proposal for something called the Multilateral Initiative on Malaria that would use one of the agencies at the World Health Organization to help organize research and training programs to establish a coordinating center that would be shared among different institutions willing to support the activities of this initiative, to provide meetings attended by African scientists in Africa, and to foster the growth of African science more generally, including the establishment of an American Academy of Sciences, which has indeed been quite successful over the past several years. Just a few years ago, 2018, I had a chance to visit Dakar again for a celebration of the 20th anniversary of the establishment of MIM, and was pleased to look out from the stage, as you can see in the photo on your left, and see as many as a couple of thousand scientists, almost all African, who were now working on malaria in Africa. The picture on the right showed that we still had political support with the president of Senegal, Macky Sall, greeting a woman from the Cameroons, Rose Leckie, who attended our first meeting and was running the meeting held just a few years ago. As I mentioned, my own conviction that this was going to work was based in part on NIH activities that had begun some years earlier when the NIH established a center for research and training in Mali. That effort was led by an esteemed scientist working on malaria at the NIH itself, Lewis Miller, who had identified some young and enterprising Malian scientists who were able to masterfully lead the effort in the Malaria Research and Training Center in Bamako. Those two leaders are shown at the bottom. The location of Mali and Bamako is shown on the top. Mali is an interesting place. It has an ancient culture that arguably peaked in the 13th century. As you, I assume, all know, it was a French colony, but achieved independence in the early 1960s and became a democratic institution, at least in part, in the early 90s. It had also been helped by a number of Europeans who had spent time trying to promote science in Mali, and I particularly point out Philippe Rank, who had been a teacher at the Bamako University for some years and had promoted the careers of the young Malian scientists who became the heads of the center that NIH helped establish in the early 1990s. A particular help to us was the president of Mali, who had been elected in 1992, himself a PhD in archaeology, when I met him on my visit to Mali, knew the names and problems of in minute detail at the center in Bamako. The center was also a source of pride to the U.S. This is a picture showing the clinical leader of the center, Dr. Duomo, presenting the activities of the center to our then Secretary of State, Colin Powell, during a visit that Powell made in the year in around 2005. As many of you probably know, things are not particularly happy in Mali at the moment. There's been unrest. It's a euphemism for a lot of terrorist activity in Mali for the last decade or more. These pictures just illustrate some of the things that have happened to make Mali a less than safe place to be. But the Malaria Research and Training Center remains an active place for work, and Malian scientists are traveling back and forth to the States and Europe and keeping the center going. So this, to me, was convincing evidence that even before these more recent events, that a place like Mali, with a very low average income and restricted, limited access of Malian citizens to the world's repertoire of knowledge and wealth, could still prosper scientifically, especially with a little help from friends in the U.S. and elsewhere. I want to stop there and talk a little bit about a similar situation with different origins that occurred in Uganda in the context of cancer research. And I want to use a description of a very brief description of the Uganda Cancer Center as an example of how building institutions in low and middle income countries can assist both the better control of disease in poor countries and the development of research activities that has a real benefit, not just for people in Uganda, but for people all around the world. And this story actually begins as long ago as 1957 with a childhood leukemia, lymphoma, that was discovered by a UK surgeon, Dennis Burkitt, who had gone to Uganda as a relative youth and observed children, usually in the ages of 4 to 10 or so, who had this very large lymphoma growing on the jaw, found that this was a highly treatable cancer, one of the first to be dramatically improved as a result of the use of chemotherapy, as illustrated by this picture showing an afflicted young boy responding to even a single dose of a chemotherapy called Cytoxan. And that kind of remarkable improvement was convincing to a lot of people that this was a very important development in the history of cancer research, and it led to additional studies that made an even greater impression. Tony Epstein, Sir Anthony Epstein, who died recently, just a couple of weeks ago at the age of 102, heard about this. He asked that in response to Dennis Burkitt's request that he be given a chance to look for viruses in the cells from these tumors. And after tumors were mailed to him in England, he found in cell lines established from these cancers that there was a virus shown at the bottom of the slide here under electron microscopic view was found in all children with this disease. It turns out that this virus is ubiquitous in the human population, the cause of infectious mononucleosis. There's still no vaccine that is approved for use, but there's continuing research on this virus because of its important role in human health everywhere, and its association not only with Burkitt's lymphoma, which is found commonly in Africa and parts of South America, but also associated with some patients who have Hodgkin's disease and patients with nasopharyngeal carcinoma in China. When some of this work was presented in the 1960s, it attracted the interest of some of my colleagues at the National Cancer Institute, including two members shown here, Paul Carbone, who was a leading member of the Cancer Institute then, my college friend, John Ziegler, who was then a trainee, who went to Uganda and worked with the Ugandan government to establish a cancer research center. Now, that research center has done well overall. It's an established place and is thriving today, but it had to endure the oppressive political dicta of several leaders of Uganda, including the infamous Idi Amin and Apollo Abate, who ran very severe regimes in which Asians, of whom there are many in Uganda, and Europeans were frequently tortured or exiled, and placed the cancer center on very uncertain grounds. Since 1985, the leader of the country has been President Museveni, who has been certainly more respectful towards the center, and the center has thrived, has developed relationships with the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle, and that American Cancer Center maintains a staff at the center. I was in Kampala for the groundbreaking of a new building, which is now constructed, that allows research to proceed there. So this illustrates some of the more difficult aspects of how work can get done, but also illustrates the principle that work that's done in Africa by African scientists who are running the center in Kampala can have effects on our view of cancer and other infectious diseases worldwide. I want to mention just briefly a couple of other approaches to promoting science in poor countries. One of them was started by Bill Gates at the Gates Foundation when he took inspiration from the work of mathematician David Hilbert. Hilbert was a German mathematician who had identified 23 unsolved problems in mathematics and wrote a treatise about these unsolved problems and called them grand challenges, and challenged the mathematical community around the world to try to solve them. Most of them have since been solved, but it represented an interesting approach to science, that is to have someone who is a seer, a wise man, a wise woman, or a committee, look at a field and identify problems that haven't been solved but ought to be. And Bill Gates recognized this might be a way to approach problems in medicine that were especially those of afflicting poor countries. And he established a program that's been called the Grand Challenges in Global Health. And he asked a committee, which I happened to chair, to try to come up, after extensive deliberation, with a series of challenges, problems that had not been solved. For example, how do you make vaccines that are not susceptible to degradation by heat, that would no longer require refrigeration to keep them viable? Or what are the elements in the immune system that have to be triggered in order to more effectively control disease? And indeed, our committee came up with 14 grand challenges that were announced in Science magazine. They attracted hundreds of applications for large awards, the 43 awards that were made averaged about $10 million apiece, and they almost always included scientists from poor countries as well as wealthy countries, providing an opportunity for scientists working in places where global health was threatened by intractable challenges to work with scientists in the northern or more affluent countries. This general approach has been emulated by many. There are now grand challenges in cancer research. There are grand challenges in non-communicable diseases. There are grand challenges that are even the grand challenges at the Gates Foundation itself have changed in character in many ways, and that has proven to be useful. So that's a matter of applying a novel approach to the design of the funding of science that brings scientific opportunities to people who are working in poor countries. The final thing I'll mention is something that is related to comments that Edith made in her introductory remarks, and that is the way in which our science council at the World Health Organization is trying to promote an approach to medical prevention and care that is dependent on a science that is fairly recent and now much more accessible to everybody. Let me just say a couple of things about this. When Dr. Tedros took over WHO several years ago, he decided to reinstitute the use of a science directorate that would promote medical science as well as medical care and prevention, as WHO traditionally does. And this council was challenged with the idea that it ought to be identifying new technologies that had the potential to improve global health and to provide ways in which access to those technologies could be assisted by funding agencies, the countries themselves. This is the council is originally formed. I chair it. Edith is a member, and there's several other well-known folks from around the world who serve on the council. In our very first meeting, we identified genomics as a topic for our first report to the Director General, with a very simple rationale that genomics was now an important technology that had many applications, not just to health, but indeed to legal matters and to archaeology, anthropology, law, agriculture, aquaculture, and that the utility had been dramatically demonstrated, not just in the pursuit of treatment of diseases like cancer, but especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. And furthermore, the technology was becoming more appealing to people in developing countries, to low and middle income countries, because the costs were declining and the feasibility of establishing genomics was becoming much greater. The Science Council set up workshops to examine some of the aspects of genomics that would be important for implementation in the future. That is a discussion of its benefits, of its operative procedures, the need for equipment and reagents and for service functions, and some of the social complexities that are established by genomics, which of course reveals very private information about individuals and concerns about who gets credit for discoveries made using these technologies and how data and databases might be surveyed. And those of you who are in Europe know that that some of the recent European Commission recommendations for how information in databases is controlled is one of those issues that needs discussion. Our council wrote a report published over a year ago that described advice for how to proceed along three or four lines of activity. One is advocacy for genomics. Second is how we implement things by training people, by getting equipment delivered to poor countries at low cost. and how services to maintain that equipment can be provided. The report recommended many ways in which even small poor countries could work out collaborative arrangements to promote the effective use of genomics, and it recommended that means be established for discussing some of the ethical, legal, and social issues that genomics raises. There has been a lot of follow-up here. This is not a report that's been filed in a waste can. It's actually an active document in which which has been widely disseminated throughout the World Health Organization system. We've established a standing committee on genomics at WHO that is providing oversight and guidance to efforts to implement genomics. We have a dedicated consultant now working with WHO in Geneva, extra funding to support this and to help arrange meetings with relevant parties from the commercial sector, from the ethical sector, and other parties that will be relevant to making genomics a viable activity, even in the poorest countries in the world. So much for some of the things that I've been observing and participating in to try to promote the use of science, the devotion to science, the creation of scientists in poor countries. And now I want to spend the rest of my time, another 20 minutes or so, on ways to share the products of medical science to promote global health. So this is not so much about the doing of science as the application of what has already been achieved by science in advanced countries. I have to say a word, although it's a slightly boring word, about efforts to advocate for this kind of activity. Because it is important to convince people, politicians particularly, but others in the general public, that investment in the use of science in countries other than our own is important. And I've been involved in a couple of such activities through the National Academies in the U.S. and through WHO itself, to make that case in a way that appeals to economists and politicians and the public. The first of those activities for me was one that was organized by Gro Brundtland when she was the Director General of WHO, and it was an effort to show that investments in health had benefit for the economic goals of even the poorest countries, and as well for the goals of wealthier countries. This committee was led by the well-known macroeconomist Jeff Sachs, now a colleague of mine at Columbia, and the effort was directed largely to judging how health had advantages for economic development in both in all countries of the world, but especially in poor countries. And we examined what the rough cost would be for reducing morbidity and mortality in many of those countries, and showed why improved health in poor countries encouraged investment from companies in the wealthier countries, improving the economic conditions in the poor countries. And in that way, it drew attention to both the costs and the benefits of improving global health. And the argument was that these were investments that did have virtue and that they improved the economics of poor countries to a greater extent than they brought about costs that were incurred by the participating countries. The U.S. has had made a somewhat different effort to try to justify the interests of a single nation in global health. And in 1997, the National Academies of Medicine and Science endorsed a report written by its members that said that that the U.S. had an enduring interest in global health because it represented a manifestation of our humanitarian concerns, but also encouraged some self-interest that were along the lines of those that that I mentioned in the context of WHO's report. But it had to be admitted at the time that this report was written in 1997 that despite these ambitions held by medical scientists of high repute, that nevertheless the U.S. was really not doing very well, and that compared to our national economic status, we were doing less well than many countries in Europe, especially Scandinavian countries, in devoting a significant percentage of our national income to matters of global health. Some years later, a full decade later, I actually co-chaired another follow-up report to the first one in the company of a distinguished ambassador, Tom Pickering, who had been thinking about these problems for 40 years. The tenor of the report was the same from a strategic point of view, but the accomplishments were changed dramatically because the U.S. by then had financed a program called PEPFAR for the President's Emergency Fund for AIDS Relief that had dramatically changed our status among countries by making large investments in the control of HIV that exceeded anything that we had done previously to improve health in developing countries. And I want to spend a few minutes talking about PEPFAR, how it became a viable program, and why it was so important, and how the program developed in a rather interesting and surprising way. So this program, which is now reasonably widely known among the American public, began with a plan for spending roughly $15 billion over 5 years to prevent a fairly specific number of new infections, to treat a quite specific number of patients already infected with HIV, and to take care of people who were affected by HIV infection, including orphans and other vulnerable children. What was particularly important about all this is that the program was conceived in 2002 when the new drugs that are used for treatment of HIV were widely employed in wealthy countries, but were rarely used elsewhere for a variety of reasons, some of it having to do with a reluctance to spend the money to do it, some of it having to do with a lack of conviction that programs of this kind could be established in poor countries, because people, it was viewed, might not be willing to properly use the drugs that were being sent from wealthier countries. Interestingly enough, this plan, the architect of this plan, which is called PEPFAR, was George Bush. The second George Bush, whose reputation as a supporter of science was not very high. I alluded to that in the first lecture. Although, as you'll hear, he was a very careful custodian of the program, he did seek help, but not from his cabinet members like Condoleezza Rice, who's shown here sitting at his left. And other cabinet members were not consulted. Instead, he depended on other advisors, Kofi Annan, the Ghanaian leader of the UN at the time, musician Bono, who's I'm sure well known to all of you. He also had internal advisors sworn to secrecy, the director of his budget activities, Josh Bolton, a private consultant who was working in the White House to help him develop the program. Tony Fauci, who is probably known to most of you in the room as perhaps the most prominent scientist commenting on the COVID crisis over the last several years, who was the leader of the of one of the institutes at NIH for over 40 years, who was privately advising George Bush about how to try to combat a disease like AIDS, and describing his own experience in trying to develop treatment programs in Africa. And then people who are working on details of what George Bush wanted to achieve with this program by doing a careful inventory of what's possible, looking at the countries that were going to be part of this program initially, finding out how much it would cost to provide the drugs and other resources that would be needed to try to combat HIV in these different countries. Still, there was tremendous skepticism among the budgeteers, the economists in the U.S. government about whether this was a viable program. And with the help of Tony Fauci and others, a team of people who had experience, albeit limited, in providing resources for treatment of diseases, especially AIDS, in poor countries, were brought together to speak with the money managers at the Office of Management and the Budget to try to convince those who were skeptics about the viability of this program. And those included Peter Magenge in Uganda, who had started an AIDS treatment program in Uganda in the 1990s. Eric Goosby, an American from University of California, who had worked to establish a similar program in Rwanda. Bill Papp, who happens to be another member of the Science Council, shown here with Bill Clinton, at a clinic that Bill Papp has established in Haiti. And the late Paul Farmer, whose Partners in Health program had also established a treatment center for tuberculosis and HIV in Haiti. And these folks met at a restaurant in Bethesda with Tony Fauci to go over the strategy for dealing with the money managers at the Office of Management and Budget. And they had decided to focus on some remarkable cases, one example of which is this case they labeled the Lazarus effect, in which that one patient who was clearly at death's door was restored to vibrant health and good fathership as a consequence of receiving anti-HIV medications in around the year 2000. And this case was a particularly significant one in establishing the conviction among the listeners at the Management and Budget Office that this was possible to do. And just weeks later, in his State of the Union address in 2003, George Bush announced this plan. His wife, Laura Bush, is sitting with Peter Magenge from Uganda in her box at that speech. Congress, previously unaware that this was developing and without any support from his cabinet members, voted to approve the $15 billion plan. And the consequence was very dramatic. As one example shown here, the red line showing the death rate from HIV/AIDS in countries that didn't receive PEPFAR support, the green line showing what happened to the death rate if PEPFAR programs were applied or were implemented. Over the course of succeeding years, the program has grown to include over 50 countries. The budget has increased, although just this year, very conservative, even right-wing Republican Party in Congress has tried to eliminate support for this program based on their concerns that the organizations receiving the money were also supporting the use of funds for reproductive rights to contraception and abortion. That effort was fortunately turned back just last week, so the program is still viable, but the threats to the program are pretty clear. George Bush much as many of us regret some of the things that he did over the course of his presidency, remains a hero for the PEPFAR program, and of course a hero in Africa, where he's recognized as the architect of the program, and someone who's compassionate conservatism, as he refers to it, bore great fruit. And I want to just conclude with a few remarks about efforts to do similar kinds of work in the area of cancer. And I remind you first that most of the things I've talked about here tonight as applications of science and healthcare in poor countries has been addressed to infectious diseases like malaria, tuberculosis, HIV. But indeed, as these countries become economically more solid, have more science, provide better medical care and do more about prevention, the causes of death in these countries have altered. Many more deaths are now attributable to diseases of metabolic diseases and diseases of the heart and lungs and blood vessels. And there is a general interest in the UN and in the countries that are in the low and middle income groups to non-communicable diseases that don't have an apparent infectious cause. And there have been a number of campaigns in the UN and elsewhere to draw greater attention to those. Among the non-infectious diseases that are non-communicable diseases that are of particular interest is, of course, cancer, the disease that I've spent most of my life working on. And cancer is going to be increasingly common as a cause of death in poor countries over the next few decades. This graph showing that the number of deaths is, it's a little hard to see from this graph, but the number of the percentage of deaths attributable to cancer in high-income countries continues to decline at about 1 to 2% a year. But the total deaths from cancers is rising quite rapidly, and all that rise is occurring in poor countries in which life expectancy is longer. Cancer is a disease associated with aging, and where infectious diseases are coming under much better control. Looking at cancer internationally is a challenge because cancer rates and cancer death rates vary dramatically from one country to another. So this requires a careful epidemiological work to establish for any country, any individual country, where the efforts ought to be placed. This is just three demonstrations comparing gastric, cervical, and lung cancer to illustrate how different the problems are in different parts of the world. And those problems are compounded by the distribution of physicians. This map from the World Mapper app shows that if you represent the size of a country by the number of working physicians, that in places like Africa and Southeast Asia and parts of South America, the number of working physicians is quite low, and that makes the care of intensive diseases, or diseases that require intensive care like cancer, particularly difficult. Nevertheless, it seemed to me when I was director of the National Cancer Institute that we ought to be giving a lot more attention than we have done in the past to the question of how cancer can be better controlled in those countries using some of the advances that I talked about two lectures ago that result from improvements in our understanding of cancer as a disease. And I think a couple of principles are particularly important. One is one that is particularly important to the consideration of steps that should be taken to control cancer in poor countries, that not everything we do to control it is actually that expensive. I'll give you some examples in a moment. And then then not all the places where we can make real progress are deeply impoverished and nevertheless deserve a lot of attention because they have the resources to do things that would be particularly beneficial to those populations that have still not benefited from the kind of science that we've done in rich countries. And then we have to consider, in thinking about how to apply these principles, that every country has characteristics that need to be taken into consideration in developing a plan for controlling cancer in that country. The science infrastructure, the health system available, the economic and political status of the country, and the numbers and the types of cancers that are cause for disease burden in those countries. Just consider a couple of examples. In Rwanda, for example, there is a tremendous interest in promoting health, and funds have been made available from advocacy organizations like the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations, support from some drug companies and some government support in Rwanda that made vaccination with human papillomavirus vaccines that prevent cervical cancer and others that are the cancers that are caused by the human papillomavirus resulted in a vaccination program that at least in the early days was much more effective as a public health measure than a similar vaccination program in the United States. The result is that cervical cancer is essentially disappearing from Rwanda. Control of smoking is another effort that is not necessarily particularly expensive as long as it gets organized. And although cigarette and tobacco use have declined dramatically in the U.S., still 19% of our population smokes, and in many countries where tobacco cessation campaigns have not occurred, such as Indonesia and quite a few others on this chart, the rates of smoking, particularly on males, remains extraordinarily high, bringing that down those rates from 40 or 50% is an effort that is definitely worth exploring. The center that we established at the NCI, National Cancer Institute for Global Health, has a set of objectives that I'll use as a way of concluding this part of the discussion today, just by outlining the general categories of activity in which I think countries that are wealthy and have made great progress against diseases like cancer can contribute to control of cancer, even in the poorest countries in the world. And one is to develop in each of these countries cancer registries so we know what cancers are there, and to develop national cancer plans that are appropriate for those kinds of epidemiological findings. Second is to capitalize on the fact that often in poor countries as many as 25% of cancers are due to infections with agents like the human papillomaviruses or the hepatitis B viruses, Epstein-Barr virus, and to develop new and make better use of existing vaccines for controlling cancers caused by viruses. Third is to think about disease prevention not as a disease-specific activity, but one that is linked to other kinds of disease prevention by controlling the use of tobacco, by reducing obesity rates. We know that obesity is responsible for perhaps 20% of all cancers, to decrease the use of alcohol and its connection with liver cancer, for example. And then to think about how health systems work in poor countries by improving the way in which people get directed for screening procedures for a variety of diseases by improving the infrastructure for doing surgery providing drugs for treatment of symptoms. All of these things can be done in a way that's not necessarily disease specific and improve the ability of countries to help control diseases like cancer. And finally, it's important to try to find partners to pursue these activities, harnessing the enthusiasm that does exist among students, and to build capacity for healthcare and, frankly, for research, even in the poorest countries, all of which are now being increasingly affected by the growth and the rates and the increased death toll of cancers. So I want to conclude this lecture and the series with an observation made by someone in a different field of science, an agronomist named Swami Nathan, who happens actually to be the father of the woman who was for a few years the director of the science directorate at WHO, Swami Nathan. And he said shortly before he died a couple of years ago that that science can only show the way to improvement in the way we live, and that it's only synergy between science and public policy through science and society that can help to make, in his case, hunger history. And I would say that the same is true for all of us who think about science that is directed ultimately to providing benefits of many kinds to society. In my own case, improvements in health, but for others, better control of our climate, of our agricultural productivity, and many other things that science can produce. So I appreciate those of you who have been able to come to some of these lectures and hear what I have to say about how the establishment works to make the science both a viable and productive activity and to help bring the fruits of science to societal benefit. And I'll be happy to take some questions once again. Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.